event setup and catering. You pay for the privilege of wedding photos in front of Cinderella's castle. If you, like me, wonder why people would want to marry or honeymoon at Disneyland, maybe, like Queen Elsa in Frozen, we just need to let it go. Until next time, when we visit America's first theme park, not Disneyland, but not far away, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia. We're made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Lily's Brazilian Bistro, offering traditional Brazilian cuisine made from fresh, locally sourced organic ingredients in the heart of downtown Chico. Lily's Brazilian Bistro serves traditional Brazilian dishes as diverse and exciting and colorful as Brazil itself. Located at 142 Broadway, they're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with dine-in and outdoor seating. More information, including to-go orders and reservations, at 530-399-0675 and on Facebook and Instagram. We're also made possible by, of course, KZFR supporters and by the North State Symphony, performing Holiday Pops December 9th, 10th, and 11th. This concert showcases a wide range of holiday music, everything from Nutcracker to Jingle Bells, including a sing-along for the audience and a featured performance by soloist Dawn Weiss. More information and tickets at northstatesymphony.org.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has... North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the...
This is Up the Road, dedicated to sustaining the California story. I'm Kim Weir. We've been exploring Orange County till now to show there's much more here than just as much more here.
Do not adjust your radio. That was the sound of electricity here in the KZFR studio. From time to time on Ecotopia, we like to stray outside the usual environmental topics to look at some ecosystems that don't ordinarily receive a lot of attention. This week, we're going to take a look at electrons, those invisible electric things you learned about in school, and which we mostly take on faith since we can't see them. I learned about electrons and electricity as a junior in high school a long time ago with Mr. Krajewski. He had a beautiful daughter. Her name was Janet. She was a year younger than I, and all the guys lusted after Janet. I never had the opportunity to date her. That has nothing to do with today's show. Aside from Janet, Mr. Krajewski explained that electricity was the flow of electrons and that electricity required just two wires, one going in, one going out. My faith in electricity and in Mr. Krajewski was shattered when I purchased a stereo amplifier do-it-yourself kit. Following circuit diagrams and soldering stuff together, I successfully got it to work. but I was largely baffled by what I was looking at, with things called resistors and capacitors and wires running all over the place. I have been mystified by electricity ever since. But as we know, saving the planet depends in no small measure on getting off fossil fuels and onto electricity. So we need to understand this mysterious stuff. In the first part of the program today, I'll interview an actual electron. I'll ask her all about herself. Then I'll interview an electrowalkal engineer trying to extend my understanding beyond Mr. Kryeski and maybe a little less distracted by Janet Kryeski. And after that, we'll hear from Butte Choice Energy about coming opportunities for us to choose to use green electricity generated by non-polluting sources instead of that being generated by fossil fuel or nuclear plants. Some of you may remember a little cartoon character named Reddy Kilowatt. He represented the electric industry when I was growing up. He had lightning bolts for arms and a light bulb for his head. This is relevant because my first guest in just a few moments is Helen Reddy Kilowatt. Stay tuned. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Tonight, our ecosystem is the electron, and we are pleased to welcome to the studio a live electron. Welcome, Helen Reddy Kilowatt. So, I'm sure that most of our listeners have heard about electrons, but what actually are you, Helen Reddy Kilowatt?
I am electron. Hear me roar in numbers too big to ignore. actually, I'm a very tiny, negatively charged subatomic particle, smaller than an atom. we electrons can be either bound to an atom or we can be free. An electron that is bound to an atom is one of the kinds of particles within the atom. The other two are protons and neutrons. We also act as carriers of electricity.
So why, Helen, are you called an electron?
I happen to be named Electron because electron, E-L-E-K-T-R-O-N, was the Greek word for amber, which is a gemstone made of fossilized tree sap. It was discovered by the ancient Greeks to develop a charge that attracted small objects after the amber had been rubbed with fur. Having heard of the ancient Greek use of the word, the Irish physicist G.K. Stoney began using the term electron when he started experimenting with electric charge, paving the way for its modern usage.
You mentioned free electrons. What does that mean, Helen Reddy Kilowatt? Are you free?
Well, since you've had the temerity to ask, I'll admit that some of us have definitely had our moments, but I digress.
Okay.
In fact, the reason some of us become free electrons is due to our being in the outer shells of some atoms, such as metals. As a result, with the addition of electrical energy, such as light or contact, we're able to easily detach from those atoms and wander around, making it easy for electricity to be conducted through these materials.
So how big are you anyway?
We electrons are so small that we act by rules completely different from those that govern objects that you can directly perceive. We sometimes act like balls, sometimes like clouds, and sometimes like waves. You can't measure our size in the same way you can measure the size of a ball. Even if it were possible for you to shrink down to the size of an electron, you couldn't measure one of us because you'd have a hard time deciding where the edge was.
I'm not sure this is helpful to our listeners, meaning me. So tell us more.
Well, electrons are so small that no one has been able to determine our size. But if you insist on an estimate, scientists have calculated the largest possible radius for one of us. And that number comes to 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter. Impressive, huh?
I'll say, like we could put millions or billions of you in a teaspoon, which leads me to ask, where do you and your fellow and gal electrons live or otherwise hang out?
Well, we live in atoms along with protons and neutrons. Because protons and neutrons are way heavier than electrons, they reside in the nucleus at the very center of the atom. But electrons are extremely lightweight, as I just mentioned, and we operate in a sort of cloud orbiting the nucleus. This type of orbit is different from orbits such as the simple orbit of a planet revolving around the sun, because electrons occupy distinct regions that are called orbitals, which surround the nucleus.
This is a far cry from what I saw in Mr. Kryeski's high school physics textbook. He had neat pictures of electrons in orbit, just like satellites.
Well, old-timer, as you have no doubt observed, time marches on, and with it, so does scientific knowledge, as well as illustrations of it. So what science currently understands is that when an electron moves, it does so without following a particular path. And in addition, we electrons cannot be located in a particular position at any one time. As a result, this behavior contributes to orbitals now being described as donut-shaped clouds, or as spheres, or as lobes that sort of look like two earlobes or two butternut squashes put together. You'll have to admit, we electrons are a multifaceted bunch.
You obviously are. My mind is spinning like a top, or maybe like an electron. So who initially figured you out?
Well, it was something of a very brainy group effort over a period of time. First, it was necessary for the vacuum tube to be invented, and then the cathode ray, which led to scientists developing a method for verifying the suspicion of we electrons' existence. And finally, a number of scientists were successfully able to use the technique to measure the conduction of electricity through gases.
Please give us the name of one of these people.
Well, although the English physicist J.J. Thomson wasn't actually the first to achieve successful measurements demonstrating that electrons are negatively charged particles in motion, he did make a crucial contribution by publishing his results in 1897, which caught the world's attention and led to his receiving a Nobel Prize for his work a few years later. Well done, J.J.
I'll say kudos to J.J. But if you electrons can't be seen, how do we know you exist?
Well, early early research by J.J. Thomson and others determined the existence of the negatively charged particle that came to be called an electron by directing cathode rays between two parallel aluminum plates toward the end of a tube, where the rays could be observed as luminescence on the glass. When the top aluminum plate was negative, the rays moved down and away from its like charge. When the top plate was positive, the negative rays were attracted upward, demonstrating that the rays were made up of negatively charged particles, as was shown by their moving toward the positively charged aluminum plate. Ta-da!
Helen Reddy Kilowatt, I'm not even going to ask what a cathode ray is. But now that you've told us you do exist, please tell me a little more about how you behave, about the community of electrons. Do you snuggle up to other electrons?
No, they repel me. As it turns out, in the case of electric charge, opposite charges attract and like charges repel. As a result, we electrons, all being negative, simply repel one another on a regular basis, really.
How sad, I guess. That leads me to ask how fast you are able to move.
An example of how fast we electrons whiz about in the atoms around you is found in the hydrogen atom, which is in all of our water. The electron in the hydrogen atom travels at about 2,200 kilometers per second, less than 1% of the speed of light, but fast enough to get around the Earth in 18 seconds. Speed varies depending on which type of atom and which part of it the electrons are in. And of course, in scientific experiments where particles are controlled by electric and magnetic fields, electrons can be caused to go much faster than ordinarily, sometimes close to the speed of light. It's a completely different story, though, for free electrons that are being conducted along wires as they move with speeds more like that of an ant on your picnic table.
I guess I'd like to go for a spin at the speed of light. But I read someplace that one of you was confined for 9 months in an electron trap. It made me wonder if there is something like electron flypaper. How did that happen?
This is not something we electrons like to talk about, since researchers have recently started using a technique involving lasers that includes tuning electrons to a highly excited state. Suffice it to say, although there are a lot of challenges ahead, quantum computers will eventually be benefiting from the long-time trapping of electrons.
I understand your angst. I hope you won't be trapped, though I'll bet we could hear you roar. So, how many untrapped electrons are there of you in the universe? Do you and your cronies sort of go all the way to the edge of the universe?
Well, scientists have estimated the number of atoms in the known universe by estimating how many atoms there are in the sun, our sun, and assuming that hydrogen atoms are the most prevalent with one electron and one proton each. Multiplying that number by how many stars there are in the known universe results in the current estimate that the number of atoms in the universe is an astounding 1 followed by 80 zeros. As Carl Sagan may have once said, every kilogram of matter in our world contains billions and billions of electrons.
Does that mean then that you were created with the Big Bang?
More or less. In the first moments after the Big Bang, the universe was extremely hot and dense and very, very tiny. As the universe cooled, conditions became just right to give rise to the building blocks of matter, which are the quarks and electrons of which you're all made. A few millionths of a second later, quarks combined to produce protons and neutrons. And within minutes, these protons and neutrons combined into nuclei. As the universe continued to expand and cool, things began to happen more slowly. It took about 380,000 years for electrons to be trapped in orbits around nuclei, forming the first atoms. And those were mainly hydrogen and helium, which are still the two most common atoms in the universe. Not quite sure when my birthday is exactly, but I think we can put the year at somewhere around 13.7 billion years ago, in case anybody out there wants to celebrate it.
Clearly, you are not showing any signs of aging. You seem to be as sparky as you were in the beginning. But your lack of social or electric contact still concerns me. Have you ever met a positron?
If I had, we would not be having this cozy chat. I can tell you that right now, mister. Electrons and positrons are antiparticles of each other, and immediately upon meeting, they mutually annihilate, and then they immediately emit two annihilation gamma rays with equal energy, which then restores the mass energy of the two doomed particles to the universe.
I confess, I'm pretty overwhelmed with all this sophisticated information. Let me ask a more down-to-earth question. Why is there a spark when I pet my cat or touch its nose?
The Greeks noticed when certain materials make contact with another, such as when you walk across a carpet, electrons can be transferred to you, building up a negative charge that clings to your body until they can be released to the very next thing you contact that does not have an excess of electrons. If you build up enough of a charge, then as you reach and touch your furry friend, you both will get a shock as the electrons jump from where they've been building up onto your cat. If you are simply too impatient to wait for the static charge to be neutralized, which will happen by attracting opposite polarity charges from out of the air, then ideally your cat would much prefer you touch a dog or a doorknob first.
I can see that. But I'm still having difficulty seeing how you electrons move about so freely. Are you always tied to an atomic nucleus? And if you can get away, how do you do it?
Well, what keeps us electrons attached to the nucleus is electricity and magnetism. The atom's center, or nucleus, is positively charged, and the electrons that whirl around this nucleus are negatively charged, so they attract each other. However, it is possible that friction or even light shining on atoms can potentially pop some electrons out of their orbits, such as happens when your shoes contact the carpet on your way toward unintentionally zapping poor unsuspecting little Miss Kitty Cat.
You and billions of other electrons are clearly a very active part in our world. I'd even like to call you activists. With all that positive energy, why are electrons said to be negatively charged? Wouldn't it make more sense to call electrons positively charged because when they move, they make electricity?
Well, see, here's the thing. Benjamin Franklin, who contributed much to the study of electricity, has often been criticized for making that word choice. But in Franklin's defense, a commenter on the Electrical Engineering Stack Exchange had this to say. Franklin's choice was arbitrary and does not correspond to the physical reality that most current is now considered to be carried by electrons. But you should keep in mind that the nature of electrons was not really established until the American physicist Millikan accomplished this in 1909. Being 150 years ahead of the details makes it easy to be thought wrong, while in fact getting most of it right, he said. And dang, Steve, I simply could not have said that better myself.
But again, my socialization concern. Why don't electrons in the atom enter the nucleus?
Well, quantum mechanics discovered that electrons can only be a limited number of distances from the nucleus. And zero distance is not one of the allowed distances. It's just a fact of nature, and that is that. As is this bit of wisdom, more or less borrowed from some Helen Reddy song. Oh, I am an electron. I am invincible. I am strong. I am electron. Need I say more?
You have said it positively and well, or maybe I mean negatively and well. You clearly are invincible. Thank you, Helen Reddy Kilowatt, for being with me on Ecotopia. You're a great spokesperson for the billions and billions of you that whiz around our universe. Now we'll take a short break, talk to an electrical engineering professor who will tell us how electrons, like Helen, get turned into electricity, the juice that powers so much of our lives. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. And the ecosystem we're exploring tonight is electrons and electricity. I'm pleased now to talk with Jim Resch. He's a friend from my days at Michigan State University, where he taught in the Department of Electrical Engineering. Welcome, Dr. Jim Resch.
Thank you.
So, as I explained earlier, my understanding of electricity is minimal and kind of limited to high school explanations I heard, I was going to say a half century ago, it was 60 years ago. So I'm hoping that you can enlighten me as well as listeners who may be as much in the dark as I am. I don't understand how Edison did give us light, but I'm glad he and you can help us see that light. So, Dr. Resch, to ask a simple question, what the devil is electricity anyway?
Well, there is no simple short answer to that question that is both general and accurate, but I'll give it a shot. Electricity is simply one of the forms energy can take. It's a natural phenomenon that occurs throughout nature and itself has many aspects. In this program, I'll focus on the aspect most people wonder about, that juice you mentioned that powers us all. Electrons flowing in a stream confined within metallic conductors. That's what we're calling electricity. The streams are known as electric currents, in analogy with streams of water.
So Helen Reddy Kilowatt traced the history of electrons back to the Greeks and maybe even beyond. How long has humankind known about electricity?
Well, the study of electricity actually began in classical times or earlier, 500 or 600 BCE, when Thales of Miletus noticed that amber gave off sparks when rubbed and would attract light objects such as small feathers. Many centuries later, some Chinese discovered Earth's magnetic field and invented the compass for navigation at sea. After a couple thousand years, the topic again became popular. An Italian named Volta invented batteries, which led to the notions of measurable voltage and current. These led to experiments with circuits using troughs of liquid mercury, unhealthily, as conductors to connect parts and wires together to form circuits. Those, in turn, eventually led a German named Ohm to discover a law that became named after him, Ohm's Law. And it led ultimately another German, Kirchhoff, to publish this full set of circuit equations. Much study of those produced modern circuit theory, which is the background I had going into my own PhD studies in the 1960s. Virtually all design of electrical circuits, electrical aspects of systems, is done these days using computers, which handle all that.
The impulse, if you will, for this program was me, for me, was a sleepless night. I started worrying about the electron supply. If electrons power our toasters and Teslas, are we at risk of running out of electrons? Aren't they consumed sort of like gasoline?
No, that's because what it is that our toasters and cars consume is the energy carried by those streams of electrons. They don't consume the electrons themselves, just the energy. Dynamos, such as those in power plants, don't create electrons either. What they do is deliver energy from one form, falling water, say, or high-pressure steam, which you get by using a source of heat to heat water, by converting that from that form into energy in electrical current. That's the motion of electrons through wires. That energy gets extracted by ohmic resistance of the wires in the toaster or stored in the batteries of our cars.
Help me out here. If they're not consumed by the toaster, where do they go afterward? Is it back to the dynamo?
Yep. So that's why there are always two wires.
Okay.
One to go there, one to come back.
That clears up my question that I talked about earlier when I got all confused by looking at the guts of an electronic amplifier. So you said something about Ohm's law. And again, I have a dim memory of calculating Ohm's law equations in high school. But what's the resistance that you mentioned?
Resistance is a property of the conductor that governs the link between current and the flow of energy. A couple of hundred years ago, that German Ohm found that a positive electric current in a wire, call it capital letter I, everyone does, coexists with a voltage capital V measured from one end to the other. He discovered what is now known as Ohm's law that I mentioned, which states that for many conducting materials, voltage V was approximately proportional to the current I. That is, V equals R times I. That current heats the wire, delivering electrical energy to the wire at rate of power P equals voltage times current equals V times I. That power is measured in units named after a pair of Brits. Joule combined into joules per second, and watt, got his name, got used for that same power. Ohmic heat is what makes the wires of a toaster. It gets hot enough to glow and burn our toast. The only reason any non-scientist cares a whit about electricity is because of such ultimate conversions of electrical energy into other forms of energy.
Yeah, I guess so. In my case, it's unenlightened self-interest. When the toast pops up, my next question is, where is the marmalade? So we kind of talked about this earlier, but are electrons reusable?
Yes, absolutely. Without wear or tear of any kind. Electrons are fundamental particles that have remained unchanged in character since shortly after the Big Bang. I think your guest, Helen Reddy Kilowatt, explained that.
This sounds to me like the old idea of perpetual motion. Is that what electrons are doing? A timeless flow of reusable juice. Might this actually be perpetual motion?
No. Maybe. No. Not perpetual at all, really. It requires energy.
You sort of answered this when you were talking about dynamos, but I still want to know, are the solar panels on my roof giving birth to new electrons?
Nope. Solar panels, like dynamos, are simply delivering energy from another form of light, or from another form, light in the case of solar cells, into electrical current for later delivery to things like toasters or car batteries. But is this a good time for me to mention that the advent of quantum mechanics caused scientists to seriously suggest that maybe there is only one single electron in the entire universe? The electron's ability to move backward as well as forward in time permits it to be simultaneously everywhere that there seem to be other electrons.
Really? I mean, seriously, do physicists actually believe that today?
Well, I'm a retired electrowackle professor, not a present-day physicist. But I think that today it's just seen as an arguable but not particularly productive point of view, maybe along the lines of solipsism.
I seem to recall from advanced placement English class that solipsism is, the philosophical idea that only one's mind is sure to exist. I will leave that idea in the minds of physicists. But now I'm still thinking about the idea of free electrons, especially complicated if there is only one. What if Putin captures that in an electron trap?
Our own electron, Helen, dealt with this. However, I think it is worth emphasizing that while some electrons are free, most at any moment are in orbit around some nucleus or another, in bondage to protons, as it were. And even the free ones are never permanently free. For each free electron, there is somewhere an atom with a hole where that electron used to be, and that hole is ready for another free electron to fall into.
But if the electrons are free, why is my power bill so high?
You're paying for receiving the energy, not for the electrons who brought it to you. They go back home.
And here's another middle-of-the-night worry along with my power bill. Does insulation make electrons claustrophobic?
That's a psychological question. Better asked of our Helen, the electron. But I might note that those streams of electrons stay within conductors, being loath to pass through or into non-conductors like insulators. In fact, air itself is a pretty good insulator, so electrical current even stays within bare copper wires that aren't coated with insulation instead of straying off into the air. But important to know, insulators have upper limits to how high the electric field strength can get before the property of insulation breaks down and sparks fly.
We know a lot about flying sparks here in the North State since uninsulated high-tension wires have fallen to the ground. They've created some of the massive wildfires we've experienced. Our electron purveyor, Pacific Gas and Electric, has announced plans to add more insulation and even to bury power lines underground. But wouldn't it be simpler just to have wireless electricity? Is that a possibility?
Well, we've always had it. Lightning is wireless electricity. We don't need that in our neighborhoods.
Right.
And so are neon lights. And they're too small for us to get in. And so are the Aurora Borealis and the other Aurora. The Aurora Antipode, also for Australians. Also, vacuum tubes are all about electrons actually moving just through a vacuum. No wires, no nothing. But Nikola Tesla devoted much of his otherwise astoundingly successful career trying to achieve the transmission without wires of vast amounts of electricity from sources like Niagara Falls to users like New York City. Tesla failed. Massive amounts of copper are still to this day needed in lieu of wireless electricity. Apple Incorporated recently tried to get us to charge the batteries of our Apple Watches and iThings without wires, and they succeeded. Well, at least for the last little gap to our devices. But doing it all the way from Cupertino to my house is not yet accomplished.
You said that Apple had succeeded yet did not succeed. How's that again?
The failure part was that Apple's wireless delivery of energy to the batteries and iThings is only accomplished across a really tiny gap between a charging device and a particular iThing. That's very far from Tesla's dream of delivering large amounts of electricity over long distances.
We'll keep that dream in mind, Jim. Thank you, Dr. Jim Resch, for being with me on Ecotopia today. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Today we're exploring the ecosystem of electricity. In this segment, I'll bring the discussion a little bit closer to home. I'm pleased to introduce Brian Ring. He's the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for Butte County. He's also the co-executive director, along with Eric Gustafson of the City of Chico, a project called Butte Choice Energy. Welcome, Brian Ring.
So, hey, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Tell us about Butte Choice Energy. What is it? How's it coming about? And what's it intended to do for our county?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, so Butte Choice Energy is a local community choice aggregation program, or often referred to as a CCA. And this concept was initially just started discussions with the Board of Supervisors here at the county level, I would say back in 2015 or 2016 even. And it was really driven predominantly at the time by businesses, specifically the manufacturing industry. They were looking at ways to try to lower electricity costs, and they thought the CCA would be one way of achieving that. So the board directed staff at that time to look into it. And I believe the whole concept went on a pause for a couple years, and then it was reestablished, or there was more interest again into it, I would say the late 2018, 2019. And we ultimately, the county did a feasibility study to see if it financially made sense, if a CCA could be fiscally sustainable and in this region. And that feasibility study proved that, yes, a CCA could be sustainable, provided, obviously, you have to have some economies in there. So the report stated that you would need to have at least the county, the unincorporated of the county, and the city of Chico. Those were kind of the two. Both of those equate to about 80% of the energy mix in Butte County. So you needed to have a significant amount of energy. So with that, we pressed forward and started to establish Butte Choice Energy. And I could talk more about that as well. But to answer your specific question, what is it? You know, why was it created? What are the goals? So a CCA is a entity formed by local jurisdictions, and it allows, the law allows local jurisdictions to form a joint powers authority that then goes out on the open market and procures energy on its own, independent of the investor-owned utility, which the investor-owned utility, or IOU, for us is Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E. Right now, PG&E, they procure the energy on the open market. They have the poles and wires. They do the whole thing soup to nuts, right? They buy it, they sell it, they distribute it, they bill for it, they do everything. With the CCA, the CCA component takes one big section out of that. The CCA buys the energy itself on the open market, or it can procure it as well, or it can make it as well. But they have to provide the energy for those customers. And then it's still a partnership with the investor-owned utility. PG&E here would still transmit or distribute the energy. They still would be a partner on the whole billing relationship. But the whole component of buying the energy on the open market would be the responsibility of the CCA. And how these have worked historically is that PG&E had a number of long-term contracts that were pretty high on the cost end. So when a CCA can come up and if you could procure energy at a lower cost, obviously, then you can sell it at a lower cost at a discount, ideally to those who are receiving it. Obviously, the energy market is very fluid. There's been a lot of actions since CCAs started to develop that have impacted costs, and we can talk about that here in a second too. But I do want to focus on what are some of the goals of it. So when we decided to go down this road, the board had a few ideas here, and frankly, you can accomplish a lot of these with a CCA. Energy reduced cost was one of the goals at the time, and ultimately, when we did our first feasibility study, I believe our consultant was targeting about a 2% energy reduction, which maybe for a resident isn't significant, but maybe for a manufacturer, it could add up. But there are a lot of upfront costs that you have to put out at the very beginning. So for any new business, you don't want to bite off more than you can chew at the very beginning. You want to make sure you pay off all your debt while you establish a reserve. And frankly, with the energy market being so volatile, you want to have a reserve to be able to go through the ebbs and flows and the ups and downs of the energy market. But a reduced cost was one of our board's goals. The other one was, you know, we had some folks on the board that were really concerned about the environment. And if you can have the choice as a consumer to procure either old or dirty energy versus clean or renewable energy, that would be a nice choice for those who wish to maybe pay a little bit of a premium mm-hmm. to purchase energy that is better for the environment. So there are a number of things that we talked about. Economic development, obviously, if you have lower rates, it might be an economic development driver for those coming into the region. There's the green component of it, the impacts on the environment, so that could be a positive benefit here. And then ultimately, what the biggest thing that I think is enticing about a CCA is PG&E, obviously, they're investor-owned, they're owned by shareholders, right? So they're there to make a profit. A CCA is not. So the whole goal is to buy energy on the open market, sell it to your consumers, ideally at a discount. But, you know, in recent years, it's been pretty on par with the investor, with the IOU. But even with that, if you can cut away, if there's a margin there that's not going to shareholders as profits, and that money can then be invested into the community locally, that's where it really, I think, the rubber hits the road and becomes an exciting program. And ultimately, as I was saying this a few minutes ago, there are a lot of startup costs, like any new business. And frankly, the biggest startup cost is buying energy. And that's, you know, millions and millions of dollars. But once you pay off those startup costs, you build up a little reserve to as I mentioned, as would be extremely prudent to be able to adapt during the volatile energy market. But then you have this, the other funds available that you can reinvest locally. And that could be into a number of things. You know, I've heard, you know, unfortunately we haven't gotten down this far, but just some things that have come up in our board meetings and other discussions, you know, biomass or biochar facilities are obviously a topic that continues to come up. EV charging stations continue to come up. Solar programs come up, as well as microgrids even have you know, come. So all those, the key component here is obviously that money would have to be reinvested in energy related infrastructure or programs. So the sky's really the limit. That's where I think it gets really exciting. But that is where, frankly, community input and the board would then make decisions on, you know, how do we want to use these resources? And that's where, you know, CCA, it's called community choice aggregation, right? Because a couple of reasons for community choice. In a perfect world, you have a couple different options for your energy mix. If you are really truly concerned and you are willing to pay maybe a premium for cleaner energy, you can do that on a monthly basis. But then once the program is up and running, you have a voice and a choice, and you can advocate for certain programs to that governing board who oversees the organization to say, hey, I think we really need to invest in this project or this project. To me, that's where it gets exciting. And we were certainly disappointed when we were very close to launching back in, I think in 2020, we were at the tail end of hiring executive director and moving this forward with a 2021 launch. And as we all know, I think COVID hit and it changed not only the financial world, but it actually changed and impacted the energy market as well. So ever since then, we've been on we're holding steady status quo, waiting for the market to shift in a way that it makes it seem feasible again. But right now we had a consultant come in last fall, I believe it was in August, and the numbers just don't look favorable right now to launch. Mm-hmm. And we certainly don't want to get in a position where we launch this organization knowing right now, based upon the cost of energy and the other limitations, that we're going to be operating in the red. So we don't want it. It doesn't make sense. So we got to be prudent with the operations. So that's kind of a snapshot of what it is and what it could do.
Great description. Yes. How large a staff is required to run a CCA? I have a vision of a Cray computer that would do a lot of the work, but obviously human input would be significant.
Yeah, you know, when we asked that question, and at least for a startup, we were thinking somewhere in the 6 or 7 personnel range. You obviously need an executive director, need a finance person, you need a buyer, a procurer, a scheduler, and then obviously you need some admin support and some customer service marketing kind of support. So I'd probably say 6 or 7 at least startup.
And I assume PG&E would levy a charge for the use of its equipment. You're bringing in the electricity over there. Their lines.
So there is PG&E, the one variable is they have a distribution charge, and they charge that to all customers right now. So there wouldn't be an increased distribution charge. Okay. It would be the same charge, but there is what's called a PCIA, Power Choice and Difference Adjustment, and that is I'll try to explain this. It's basically a charge that is allowed based on the fact that the investor-owned utility has procured energy on behalf of its customers, right? And if those customers all of a sudden say, hey, we're leaving you, PG&E, it basically leaves PG&E with what's called stranded costs, or they have these commitments to buy energy on the open market. And it's a tool that so PG&E or the IOU doesn't get stuck with those costs. So those are charges that are charged onto a CCA right now to help offset that fact. Mm-hmm. It's been a pretty highly contested and continues to be a contested issue between CCAs and the investor-owned utilities at the PUC.
This is also an issue for owners of rooftop solar, that is, PG&E is concerned about. Well, the cost of it purchasing energy, as well as the amount of energy coming in, the popularity of rooftop solar. And so just this week, they're doing some revision of their plans, and they would like to change the payment and repayment system for rooftop solar. So, yeah, they've got major concerns about all of this as well. I see that the CCA would also have the ability to develop energy on its own. You mentioned biomass. Can we envision, say, a forest of windmills or solar panels somewhere close to home that would be part of the process?
Oh, I would hate to even speculate. Ultimately, that would be the will and decision of the board at the time. And obviously, I should have said, that as far as timing goes, so when a CCA launches, typically they're going to have all that debt that I mentioned. It has to be paid off, and it takes a good couple years to pay that off before they build up any sort of a fund that would be used to invest in such projects. So even once it started, probably 3, 4, 5 years might be a timeline before any of these projects come to fruition. So, but I mentioned biomass, I mentioned the microgrids, because those are just topics that have come up today. Obviously, what's going to happen in 4 or 5 years, it's hard to say what would be the needs of the community at that point in time. But yeah, I mean, if there was a desire and a will to generate electricity somehow and use that either, for municipal government, or it's hard to say, but there's really a lot of options that can be done for, with those dollars. Again, the key is they have to be invested in utility related matters.
Yeah, it seems like a tempting project for entrepreneurs. I could see local businesses say, hey, we could get in on this, maybe make a little money and provide a service to the community. I told you on my notes, I had this silly question. If I sign up for clean energy, how do I know I'm getting green electrons rather than dirty electrons?
Yeah, it's funny. I've been asked that before. And as far as I know, your lights aren't going to shine any differently. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, based upon the desire of the consumers within the CCA, that would drive, how much energy is purchased, whether it's a renewable energy or greenhouse gas free or dirty energy. So based upon the mix, the CCA would procure energy to meet that. So ultimately, you're not going to see anything on the consumer's end, but you're going to know that you're contributing to the cause to help the environment.
Mm-hmm. Where can listeners learn more on follow the development of Butte Choice Energy?
Yeah, so we do have. We're normally scheduled for monthly meetings. We did have a meeting back in, I believe it was, I'm looking at my calendar here. Oh, August and September. And then we ended up canceling our November meeting. Because ultimately, once the board decided to push this out a year, we're on a pause again. So what I anticipate happening now is we'll reconvene in 2023, probably in early 23, maybe February. And then from there, we'll establish a plan for how to reassess the financial viability of the operations. But we do have a website where everything is completely up to date on there. We have our meeting notes, our meeting agendas on there. And that's a great place, I think, for people to, if they really wanted to follow along and see where, what the latest is on Butte Choice Energy, and it's ButteChoiceEnergy.org, www.ButteChoiceEnergy.org. And then once we reconvene, if the financials look more viable, then I really hope and anticipate a lot of public involvement. Because once the operations get going and you're buying energy, you're setting rates, you're developing energy programs, again, that's where community choice and input really comes into play. Up until then, obviously it's a matter of do the financially make sense.
Yeah. I want to thank you, Brian Ring. This is an exciting project. We're sorry it got slowed down a little bit because of COVID and so forth, but I know our listeners will be excited about it, particularly the environmental considerations. Really appreciate you. Butte Choice Energy, Brian Ring. I just lost. You are the chief administrative officer for Butte County in this project. Thank you so much for being
Deputy
with
Chief.
Me. Deputy Chief, thank you for being with me on Ecotopia today.